netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
FX Guide is proudly sponsored by SIGGRAPH Asia. FX Podcast is the official podcast of SIGGRAPH Asia, this year being held in Hong Kong, December 12th to 15th. For more information, go to siggraph.org/asia2011.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. This week, Mike Seymour is going to talk with Rob Legato about the new Martin Scorsese film, Hugo. Last time Mike was in Los Angeles, we went to an all-guild screening through the Visual Effects Society. It was both a screening and a Q&A with Scorsese, Rob Legato, the editor, and a few other folks. The film was done, except for one scene in the opening sequence and the end credits, and for that opening scene, they actually had cut in the previs. We love the film, and since then I've seen the film again in a theater. It's been a while since I've heard so many positive things as people walked out at the end of a movie. For visual effects fans, you can't get more on target than a great film about one of the pioneers of the craft, Georges Méliès. I mean, the VES logo is the rocket to the moon image that features prominently in the film. We have a lot of coverage coming up on Hugo on FX Guide. Besides this podcast, look for a written article, and we'll be covering it on one of our other podcasts, The VFX Show, so I hope you'll check that out as well. Let's jump now to the interview with Mike Seymour, talking with Rob Legato about creating the world of Hugo Cabret.
What's your name, boy?
Hugo. Hugo Cabret.
So thanks so much for joining us, Robin. Congratulations on the film. As you know, I saw it in Los Angeles when it was almost completed, but it was, I think it's magnificent.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I'm sorry you didn't see the opening shots, which got these incredible reviews in the critics. They've been, you know, reviewing specifically though the shot that you didn't see. So
actually, though, it was particularly informative to see this opening shot flying down on Paris in what was apparently stereoscopic previs. Because yeah. I took my glasses off to check. And did you previs much of it in stereo?
I did quite a bit of it in stereo, just to see what it would feel like and do. And then because we used it for screenings as well, we also had it produced in and that was that particular shot was the very first shot we did. And we were selling at the time to Marty is the idea of snow. The beginning of the film was slightly different, where the film was going to start, and as they walk away, then it was going to start to snow for the first time. And we thought it looked so cool, the snow in 3D, that we wanted to show Marty that. And then he sort of, liked it because of how it looked in 3D at the opening of the movie. So it became sort of one of those work in progress things that becomes, you know, pretty informative. And that was the very first shot that we prevised, and it was the very last shot of the last minute of the last day that we got in the movie.
Wow. I'm going to ask you about something, but I have to make a confession first. When I saw the film, and because they had alerted us to the fact that there was a couple of shots unfinished, mm-hmm. I apologize for this, but I saw the shot of the mouse on the top of the stall or the shop when it had been rebuilt early in the film, and it moves around the top of the tabletop, and uh-huh. I thought, oh, they haven't finaled that shot yet because it doesn't have motion blur. Now, I've since discovered that you deliberately actually did that as sort of stop frame animation as one of many homages in the film. I was wondering mm-hmm. if you could talk about that, because obviously I took the wrong thing out of that. Of course, I, in retrospect, feel an idiot for not seeing that, but there must have been points where clearly you could have done something, in the case of that mouse, more technically perfect with CG, but the film enjoys such a rich body of these classic techniques. Could you talk about that?
So, I mean, the whole movie is essentially celebrating persistence of vision and what it meant to the early Flickers and the, you know, Nickelodeons and all the various things. And the film is so sort of rich with an homage and appreciation for that, that it was just simply Marty wanted to do it. He just said, I want to do this as stop motion. And it was like, all right, oh, sure, you know. And we sort of got behind the idea of it because it looked like and felt like a deliberate, you know, obviously you could do something so much different and better, but it almost makes it a tad more magical, I guess, the best way to describe it. It tells you the story, but it does it in sort of this charming, old-fashioned way, especially these days when you don't really need to do stop motion anymore. That the easiest way to do motion is just do a CG mouse. But it kind of would lose that little emphasis. And if you notice in the rest of the movie, there is an homage to like a zoetrope in the pictures that are coming out of the box, and things are flipping over, and basically stealing Muybridge tricks and things like that to use those to help illustrate the story that we're trying to say. So it was definitely a purposeful item. It was very straightforward to shoot. We shot it actually on a Canon 7D camera because at the time I couldn't get another 3D camera and hold it long enough to do a stop motion sequence. So this company, Passion Pictures, that's who it is, came over and they had a special rig to make 3D out of their out of the one camera, and they animated. I showed Marty a test in my office, and he sort of loved the idea. And we made it a little fanciful that it kind of, and the story point is that it kind of does something that is almost his ability change or alter the property of the mouse to stick its head up and kind of address him in some way. That we thought that would be kind of a good little story point in there. And Marty went for it. He liked it. He wanted to do it, and that became a running theme throughout the movie, is some form of persistence of vision all the way through.
Yeah, because obviously as the film went on, I started to get more clued in to what I was watching, and that made it that much more enjoyable. And I understand that there are even homages that are sort of considerably more subtle than that. For example, there are shots of the train in the station that I believe match the Lumiere brothers shot where the people are ducking from the train approaching on the screen. And you're actually like sort of, actually referring to original films from the era in your general cinematography of the film. It seems fascinating.
Yeah. Well, that's what we did specifically. One of the sort of a little bit of a tangent is the very first beginning of the research when we were all in Europe together as we were prepping the movie, we went to Paris to look at locations, and then we saw his name is Terry. He runs the Cannes Film Festival, and he restored the Lumiere Brothers films. And so we got a chance to see, literally in 1895, the very first films run through a camera and preserved and steadied, and they just look like they could have been shot yesterday.
Wow.
And we just got so jazzed by the watching, the next time they shot something, it got a little better. The next time they shot something, it got a little better. And all of a sudden, it wasn't just about photographing or recording an event. It became art started to filter into it. And we just got such a kick out of it. I can't even begin to describe it. It was something about going back to the very, very moment that film was born. And that became sort of everybody got infused by that. And then Marty wanted to do direct homages. And literally in the train station, we lined up the camera. I did a DX of the original train coming into the station with our setup, so we could get it as close to as it as possible. Not mirror it exactly, but make an homage to it. Emulate it, not copy it. And they're very clearly in that sequence. And there's other ones. La Bête Humaine was another one where Marty wanted to sort of quote the engineers who are in there. They look very similar to, and have the same wardrobe and costumes and similar shots to that particular film. And Rooftops Over Paris was another homage that we did, and some of the rooftop shots that we did for the matte paintings and things like that. And so everything had this sort of tie-in. And there was another interesting thing that was done as well, and my daughter picked up on it, was because we featured the train coming into the station, the new modern version of the train coming in the station is the train really comes into the station. And if the audience were wowed by that back then, not that we're trying to get the same effect, but ours is the train really comes into the station and people really have to run out of the way. And in 3D, we thought it would be another sort of homage to just like Safety Last becomes an homage in the sequence where he's hanging by the clock. You know, you see the way it was done then, and you see now our new version of doing the same sort of thing, same idea, just done in different styles and specifically different styles. But it's the same gag. It's the same idea. So it had all these little sort of fun references and homages and you know, tipping your hat to, you know, films that have happened in the past. So there's quite a bit of that.
I mean, obviously the Harold Lloyd references with the clock and stuff are very strong visually. But there are, I think, interestingly, as much as this is a tribute and a sort of, I guess, a love letter to filmmakers, it's also incredibly so to the birth of visual effects, which, of course, is your area. And I guess one of the things I was interested in is the range of techniques you use. So, for example, the dream signal, the train crash that happens in the film, you actually did with miniatures, which I thought was great.
Yeah, I did, and not all miniatures. We did, you know, CG as well, and the things that we couldn't actually get a miniature to do. We found, you know, one of the hard things in 3D is the cameras are so big, you can't get the cameras close enough to the miniatures to get some of the shots that we wanted to get.
Right.
But we still wanted to do the, and again, it's going back to the homages of things. Just didn't want to do a film where I did all CG. Like I really wanted to shoot some models just as another thing in there, and it helps set the tone for even the CG shots to match to something that is ultimately realistic in its sort of visual effect trick of it. And, you know, because obviously back then they had miniatures in which we show the train crash in a miniature that George Méliès did, you know, just, you know, in the gala. So everything had some sort of reference back again. But the techniques that we used for that was just about everything that you could imagine, you know, in modern day stuff and old stuff is what we did. You know, split screens, and we did some roto where the guy almost gets knocked over by the newspaper stand as the train goes through. You know, it was literally hand roto for that particular chunk, so it's like literally every trick in the book pretty much is what we did. The hard part about the sequence is that, you know, we had budget restrictions and things, they gave me one day to shoot the train crash. You know, the once it hits the station. So I had two cameras and I went like a madman and photographed all the plates, knowing what I was going to do with it later. So it was I don't know how to describe it other than it was a very difficult task. And to shoot that quickly, I needed to rely on the other things that I could do later to fill in the blanks, because for the most part, the majority of it is all against green screen, because that portion of the station where you're looking back, that didn't exist on the set. There was no set for that.
Yeah, and you mentioned there a second ago hand rotoscoping, but another sequence I think New Deal worked on for you was the father flashback with the flames. Oh. And did you not hand tint that?
We hand painted it. It was an odd thing to do because, you know, we shot the miniature and the miniature looked great and looked very realistic and all that stuff. But Marty had his heart set on, he wanted to imitate or create basically what George did in hand coloring the flames, and for whatever his reasons are, he wanted to do that, and so that's what we did. We basically shot it realistically, and it looked very good, and I was very happy with the technical aspect of it. And then we turned it into black and white, and had somebody literally go in and do the modern day version of what they were doing back then, which is frame for frame, hand rotoing, on purposely not perfectly, the way they would have done it based on, in fact, to make it look, imitate it, had them shrink down the image so they weren't seeing a full image. The rotoscopers were not seeing a full image on the screen, but seeing a quite a bit smaller one. So it made it harder for them to actually keep within the lines. And so it purposely made it, you know, back then just literally hand painting on film.
So in other words, it was a full resolution file, but just zoomed back. So they couldn't, I mean, you wouldn't have any loss of resolution on screen when it's projected, but you actually had the lack of precision when working, I guess.
Yes, it was literally imitating the lack of precision.
Wow. And of course, in stereo.
Yes, in stereo, of course. And in fact, in stereo, we've increased the effect. of that. So it Marty definitely wanted to come into the screen, into the audience. And, you know, somebody said, well, you know, you're obviously not finished with that shot. That looks like a temp. It's like, no, that's what he wants. He wants it to look that way. And I don't know if it had anything to do with, you know, that it was in fact for kids and you wanted it to be kind of a memory or story that's being told, as opposed to an absolutely dead real thing that is more frightening by having this little sort of storybook element. You know, we're always on that line of how realistic to make things and how much, you know, to blur the line so that it is a boy's memory of, and because you're looking at the movie through his eyes, of what things looked like or imagined to be like back then. And so this was, I think, you know, almost like if the kid were to picture what happened to his father, he might picture it seeing a hand painted, because color didn't exist at the time, a hand painted version of it. So, you know, if that was the reason for Marty's decision or not, I'm not entirely sure, but it may have been.
You know, it struck me that there were obviously other techniques. You talked about the mouse, but there were actually like stop frame. Well, the collapse of the glass studio, for example, that was like a stop frame sequence, I presume.
Yeah, that was like a sort of a hybrid of a time lapse and a compression of time by something that would have taken months to do in a short period of time. So it wasn't quite.
I mean, I assumed it was staged, but I also you'd actually do it, right?
Well, we use as the basis the art department went in and screwed it up a little bit, but not nearly what we have there. And then it got turned into CG, and we did all the work basically in CG. So it's really a computer generated version of it. And initially, because it was stated to be a time lapse, they went whole hog and made up a time lapse scene with the clouds racing and the snow and all the stuff, and it looked pretty cool. But it was too real for Marty, so he didn't want to do that. It was too distracting, so he didn't want to imitate that style. And we've done the same thing at the beginning of the movie too, which is the traffic turns into streaks, like it's time lapse, but without the artifacts of time lapse,
right,
which is things are zipping in the air and you know things are popping on and off. So it was none of that. It was just like this kind of a soft. Reference to something you have seen before, but never really quite as smoothly done as this. And that was also a very specific choice. And of course, you know, visual effects artists, it's like, you want a time lapse? Watch this. I will make it look exactly like it was photographed with a stop motion camera. And you know, that wasn't what we were trying to get. So,
you know, I've discussed this a bit with you in the past, but I think it's worth revisiting. The role that you had on this film is really from, and I'm not coining this phrase, I know, but it's really visual effects director, because a lot of the stuff you're talking about is working like in a sense like a second unit director as a visual effects director, because I mean you're shooting a lot of this stuff also, but of course you're trying to work out the direction that these visual effects are going to be in. I think the role of visual effects supervisor maybe isn't, I assume that was your actual title in the film, but it seems
in my case, because I do multiple things and I was the second unit director and cameraman and I was the visual effects supervisor, so when you lump those categories together, it kind of blurs the line, so you're really there to figure out how to do a scene however it's done,
yeah,
however you wish to do it. So it's now just goes purely into filmmaking. What do you want it to look like? What's the tone? What's the, you know, all the stuff. It's not the gag or the trick of being a visual effects supervisor. Oh, I know how to now, once the shot is stated, I know how to do it. It's, you have to now state the shot and the intention and which portion is going to be thrown to shooting it live, which portion is going to be a plate, which portion is going to be a miniature, you know, all that stuff that you figure out. At the same time, the stuff that you're going to do live, that you're going to solve the problem with an in-camera gag or, you know, literally, I mean, just shooting films, everything is an in-camera gag. I mean, it's all a trick to some degree. So, and once you get, you know, I hate to make it sound this way, but once you sort of get adept at it, the next challenge is what is it that you're doing? What are you trying to say, as opposed to how clever it is, how I say it? It's what is the underlying thread or the story or the tone or the feeling you're trying to get over the body of the entire film? And so it definitely is a blurred line. It's not compartmentalized like, okay, you just do the visual effects, the cameraman just does the camera work, this guy just does this, and, you know, it's all together, and we all sort of work together, you know, and I work with Bob. We spend a lot of time just setting up the DI theater to do the dailies, and how does the 3D look, and how's it work, and what works better, and, you know, and it becomes a blurred line between what he does and his contribution and my contribution, especially at the beginning, because we're sort of figuring it out together to create the tone and the mood to present to Marty for him to say, yes, that's more what I had in mind or less what I had in mind. And film is a cumulative art. You do that and you go, oh, you know, it would be great now that I see that step, let's try this. And it all kind of, you know, works together. It's like it's all in one soup, and hopefully you put all the ingredients together and it's what you wanted it to be. So there is quite a bit of blurring of those things, especially if you make up the scenes. And then what emotion do you wish to elicit by what the final image looks like? So, I mean, that's how we, you know, that's how we attack it, or I attack it, or whatever. But
yeah, I mean, it's almost, to use sort of another department, I mean, many people who don't know our industry assume the director of photographer camera operates, but of course, director of photography is not, you know, principally concerned with the actual operation of the camera. They're concerned about the lighting and the framing of the shots, and in a certain extent, you know, there's a point at which you seem to be doing that directorially, but again, in the same sense, in line with the vision of, in this case, Martin Scorsese. I'm wondering, though, if I could use an example of that and drill down on it, and that is there's some really nice long, what I would normally call Steadicam shots in the film. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, ever since the days of Goodfellas, a Scorsese long kind of Steadicam shot is a treat for any filmmaker. But in these ones, I just couldn't get over the fact that you had a stereo rig, and while I'm sure you could get stereo on some version of a Steadicam, these were impossible running around the sort of the non-front of house part of the station. And so as a consequence, there were just, for example, there's a bit where you go down to like what seems like almost like a coal chute or mm-hmm. and I'm like, okay, there's no way you got a stereo camera to go down there.
That is correct. There is no way that you can get a stereo camera down there.
So let's say for a second, and I assume this is the case, that at some point Martin Scorsese said that he wanted this continuous shot for the stylistic reasons that are very valid in the film. You have to solve that. So how did you kind of approach that? How much did you do live action? I mean, you must have done a lot of it, but how'd you pull it off?
Okay. How I pulled it off was first, part of the previs portion of it is you can't just previs stuff wildly that can't be actually achieved. So part of the previs is, here's all the gear I have, here's what the cameras look like, here's all the stuff, and here's what our intent is. And so you start prevising it with all of the knowledge in mind. And so I prevised and made up at one continuous tone to even dictate what the sets are. How long does he run? How much travel is he going? So you basically have to start somewhere. So I started with a previs of saying, okay, let's pick a couple of moments that are kind of fun and not to be impossible to do, but is what you would want to do, like the, and I always had in the back of my head is the Goodfellas shot, is yeah. The shot is not just a cool shot. It is telling a story of what it's like to be that guy in Goodfellas. And so this thing is, what is it like to be a kid who your where you live is you're a complete control or command of it. You can go areas and go places that no one else can do. You know, secret hideaways and passageways and things and shortcuts. So we came up with a couple of what you consider gags and said, okay, now I got to glue them all together. So, and then I have to figure out, in this particular case, there was five separate sets built at five separate times on five different stages. So it was, you know, you have to kind of really have a pretty firm idea of how you're going to glue this together to create this one sort of Goodfellas-esque shot, in that it the journey tells the story. And so what I did is I basically found the sets that we had, and the easiest way for me to photograph it was with a crane, the Luma crane, because it gives me a tremendous amount of flexibility, because you could get rid of the arc of the crane and be basically like a Cartesian rig or whatever you'd call it, that basically does XYZ. So no matter how complicated the move is, to the camera, it's really an XYZ move. It's moving straight back, going up, going to the left, going to the right. With although I have to mechanically figure out where the post goes and all that stuff, it still is figure outable, I guess, is the best way to describe it. And so we started with the thing, and then I said, okay, now when I am done with this set, I have to figure out a camera trick to get into the next portion of the set. So one of them is going straight from the clock, and he runs basically the camera tilts down, and then he basically goes down a ladder.
Yeah, sort of skids down it.
Yeah, and he skids down it, which is my, you know, what I wanted to do, because if I were a kid, I wouldn't want to climb down a ladder, besides the fact it would take too long, and to show off his exuberance or his, you know, mastery of his environment, you would put 2 feet on either side of the ladder and just slide down like a version of a fireman's pole. So to do that, of course, everybody said, well, that's unsafe, you can't do it. So we had to build basically a elevator with the two rungs, and then we put all of the cross rungs in CG and got rid of the little green thing that he was on. But I had him do I shot that portion of it. So I had him do the action where he literally is putting his feet up against the rungs, and just his heels are on the green screen platform he's on. And it literally, you know, the physical effects guys are driving it down while our camera, which is on the Luma crane, chasing him down. And then the set was built in such a way that once he gets chased down, I now push forward to him to go to the coal chute, and that's the end of that set. So that was that portion. So the first set is he's running out by the clock. He puts the four back in the clock, runs to the next section where it travels down, and then to the coal chute. And then the next thing was sort of interesting. The coal chute area is there's no physical way to get a camera around, you know, 2, 3, 6. Yeah. To the thing, it's just impossible. So what I came up with was, which no one believed it would work, but it's sort of physics, so it has to work at some point, is I could have the crane basically just go straight down and rotate the coal chute underneath the camera. So basically is going in as if it's like the threads of a screw where
you're rotating the room rather than rotating the camera around the room, so what are you saying?
Correct. That's correct. So, okay. And all the crane has to do is just go straight down, and because we're rotating the set, his butt is sliding underneath the set. So he's really sliding. He's doing the whole thing, except he's sliding in what amounts to be one spot until he leaps off and runs into what would be the next set. No one thought it could work, because if you think about it, you're basically saying that the rotation of him spinning and the camera remaining on his back are in such sync that you're basically framing him as if you're sliding down the slide with him.
Right. So if you rotated the room too fast, he'd bump back into the camera because the camera would catch him up. And if you didn't rotate the room fast enough, he'd sort of go around the corner.
Yeah, he'd go around the corner and we'd miss him. So what I end up doing is they wanted to put it on a motor, and I said, don't put it on a motor. Everything has to be live. So we have three guys turning the rig, and everybody sort of adjusting to themselves at the same time. So it took, you know, about 18 takes to get it.
God, yeah.
But we finally got it, and everybody was like predicting it's not going to work. It's not going to work. It's like, well, it can't not work. It may just not work very well. I mean, and so the idea has to work.
Or may take a long time to get to work.
And you know what? It took a long time to set up, I'll say. I mean, to build the thing and get it to rotate and all this stuff. And then the hard part is lighting something that's stationary to look like it's moving, you know, 360 degrees. So,
of course, because the lights have to move with it, don't they?
Yeah, the lights have to move with it. So I had a bunch of lights around the room that I would just turn on and off. And it got complicated enough that once you put the set in there, which is a CG set that is actually rotating, we put what appears to be practicals in there to justify the lights that I just sort of hung and just turned on and turned off. And I lit quite a bit. I'd use a 20K, just jammed it straight down the middle of it. So the middle of it sort of glows. And, you know, what sells the gag is the fact that, well, because the thing is rotating, once you match the exact speed of the rotation, which we had on an encoder, so we could record how fast it's actually rotating. And once you put the room in there, now it looks correct. It looks like the camera is moving with him around the set and revealing that you're doing a 360 in this room. And then we have to, you know, now change direction with the camera. It has, it's actually kind of a complicated gag. That's why I had to shoot it myself, because, you know, I could never get it to, you know, turn it over to Bob or Marty to do, because it's too complicated an idea. And at the, what happens sometimes is people abandon things before they could understand that they can work. So, you know, I made sure that I did those for, and they were glad to have me do it, because, you know, they don't need that kind of time with that. And we switched kids too. We had the real kid for the opening portion of the shot. And then we switched for sliding down the ladder and going to the chute. The coal chute is the stand-in. Then going down the coal chute is the stand-in. And then I shot the next chunk of it, which is he now runs through and jumps up and he taps the light. And I sort of threw that in there because that's what I would do if I – this was my background. I mean, when I was a kid, I would always jump and see how high I can hit whatever is – you know, so that became another sort of Goodfellas-esque storytelling moment, is here's how comfortable he is. He does this all the time, and there's a little tick of him doing it all the time. And that was take four, and, you know,
when you're talking about jumping in light, that's when you're going parallel to him.
Parallel. Now yeah. I'm using the same rig on a completely different set and driving camera right and dolling with him.
Yeah.
It took like four guys to move this giant Luma rig, because as soon as he comes out and goes underneath the that giant wheel and comes out the other side, now we have to start craning up with him on a spiral staircase to go into the next portion of you know, to blend into the next portion of the next set.
Can I ask though, that huge cog that he jumps through, was mm-hmm. that real or was
that? That was real. It was you know, safe. It was plastic, but it was real.
Right.
It was a physical object, and that was part of the previs. Is how do we add yet another gag in there that again a kid would or could do, and an adult may not want to go through that, but if you time it exactly right, you could, you know, you're small enough, you can go through the opening of the wheel, the spoke of the wheel that allows your smaller person to go through. And so that was another thing, is like, how, what do we put in the middle of this set that he's going to, so it's not just shoe leather of going from point A to point B? What other story can we reinforce the story that we're trying to make? And then, you know, so that's all one piece. After the coal chute is picking him up, going laterally across the frame and craning up. And that took a while to get that gag exactly right. And of course, I had to remove portions of the set that I've later put back in just physically to get the camera in there to look like it's a Steadicam, that you're, you know, running with him. You're not really running with him. You're on four guys pushing a giant crane with this basically refrigerator-sized rig at the end of it, all to look like it's perfectly nimble, all to look like it's a Steadicam shot. And so then we do that portion. Of course, I have to devise how we're going to transition from one, you know, kid to the next. And then the very last piece, that was actually a Steadicam.
But going down that last bit to the clock mechanism, I mean, that's a really narrow kind of – it feels like a very narrow kind of hallway. But that was all just a well-done piece of Steadicam?
Yeah, it was a well-done piece of Steadicam. I believe, if I remember correctly, he wasn't running with it. He was on a wheelchair-esque device and being pushed on it and just keeping the camera steady.
Right, and then presumably at the very end, he looks through, and that must have been, what, a green screen shot at the end when he looks through the clock?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. So that's quite a few elements there.
Yeah, it's a pretty elaborate thing. And all throughout, I'm adding dust and debris and pipes and stuff to make it feel further like it is, you know, you're in a small environment. because you have to establish, because basically if you start peeling everything away to get the camera through, then it looks like anybody can run through it. And so you have to start putting back some objects and things in it to make it look a little more cramped and crowded.
And as you say, just as in Goodfellas, where he's basically showing his then date, his sort of confidence and knowing all the tricks of getting into the club and getting the best seat and stuff, so too this showed, you know, Hugo's confidence in moving around his environment. It's an interesting parallel.
Yeah, I mean, that was in my head, and I don't know if – Marty didn't say I want to do my own – I want to, you know, homage my own shot. But, you know, as a fan of Goodfellas and Marty and shots, I mean, what I like to do myself, successfully or not, is that I don't like to do just wow shots that are – have no story content to them. So I appreciate when – that shot is not just a bravura camera move. It's really a bravura storytelling move where in one piece of information, in one piece of you know, the amazing thing is the story that's being told unbroken in Goodfellas. So if we were going to do something like it, I had to basically use that as my, as you know, what to raise the bar to, because otherwise it's just shoe leather, and otherwise it's just showing off, you know, how you could, you know, stitch shots together. So part and parcel of it was the gags themselves telling you the story that the one camera shot is revealing, much like in Goodfellas, where, you know, the who he's paying off, going through the kitchen, all the various things, wasn't just, you know, and then ending up where he ends up, you know, is telling a complete story. It's telling, so at any rate, that is, that was the sort of the genesis of that shot. But it all started with Previs to figure out what to do, how to build it, how long, you know, and we changed the set based on the timing of it. You know, the first couple of whacks at it, you know, you start and it's a little too long, and Marty's comment was, well, it takes too long. I mean, I don't want to spend that much screen time on it. So then we start saying, okay, well, to do that, the set has to be this big, because as soon as I do these transitions, he has to run that entire thing, and it's going to take X number of, you know, moments to do it. So let's change the set.
But Rob, unlike Goodfellas, you had the problem that not only do these shots have to match in terms of color and lensing and stuff, but you had to make them match stereoscopically. You couldn't be jumping around in interocular and, I mean, they had to feel like the one shot from a stereo point of view. That's a whole extra layer you had to deal with.
Yeah, and well, that becomes part of the ritual of prevising it or creating the blueprint, is you have to make sure that that is part of the a program. And then you are, you know, as you're, you know, we were, and what I recommend to everybody who does a 3D movie, you have to watch it in 3D. You cannot shoot it and then go, oh, shit, I should have done this. It's like, you have to see it so that you know that these gags will work in terms of where the, because you could be thrown off completely if the IO is wrong, or the convergence all of a sudden does zips to another thing, you know, as the camera changes, that you can't really have that happen. So it all has to be kind of you know, worked out in advance. It's a science and art project at the same time, and they have to be sort of done at the same time. The art and the science have to be melted together to actually do it. That's where, again, the blurred line of, you know, where I, you know, I'm the visual effects supervisor, the second unit director and cameraman, and sort of the you know, helping Marty basically create the shot and the pieces, and then talk to the art department about what needs to be built, how big, how tall, what needs to be, you know, a breakaway. All that stuff is all one moment. It's not just somebody else designing a shot, the visual effects supervisor coming in and saying, well, if you do it that way, we have to do this. And then the director saying, here's what I want, and the director of photography saying, this is how I have to light it. It's all done in one go. You know, all the stuff is done successfully, and Bob and Marty shot the opening portion where he's at the clock and he runs to the ladder. That's that portion they shot. And then the last portion, which is the Steadicam shot going to the letter, but they did it based on the blueprint that I made up, and then I shot all the middle stuff. I shot all the other pieces.
When I spoke to you in L.A. After the screening, as you know, one of the shots, the sequences, I guess, that just impressed the bajillicans out of me. I mean, I love this stuff we've been just talking about, but I couldn't get over the fact that you'd done anti-aging in stereo. And, of course, not knowing how you did it when I spoke to you then, I assumed that you must have anti-aged it and then dimensionalized it, and you put me straight. Can you talk about that? Because it really is actually, for some people, maybe, you know, it's not like the big effects-y stuff, but for me it was just dauntingly well done.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, I can't take any credit for that other than saying the only people who can do it has to be Lola, because they have done it before and they're very successful at it. And I was nervous about, I mean, the fallback position is we'll shoot it in stereo, we'll dimensionalize those shots, and then, you know, that has to work. And the fact that we shot it in stereo would tell you exactly how to dimensionalize the shots. And what Lola did, and you might have to you know, find out directly, because here's what I believe we talked about, and here's what I believe they did, is they in fact did the de-aging on one eye, and then projected it on his face in stereo, but left the stereo of the rest of the scene intact. They didn't make the whole thing a 2D shot and then a dimensionalized 2D shot. They essentially just dimensionalized the work that they were doing, so it was on two eyes, put in exactly the same spot. But it was done so deftly that that I was very impressed with what they did and the work that they did. And
actually, after I spoke to you, I was over at Hydraulics and Lola, and I spoke to Edson. And you know, of course, absolutely, they did do it both for left and right eye. They didn't dimensionalize it. And I've got to say that one of the things, I mean, apart from the fact that that is just superb work, one of the things that gave me the luxury of doing is being able to see some of your work stereoscopically on a digital projector where we could park the projector and, mm-hmm. and just A and B roll it. And Edson himself pointed this out to me, and so I'm going to use it as a slight divergence. But we parked on a shot where they'd done a small amount of de-aging work where he's painting a psych, I think it is. It's a sort of like a shot from the stage looking down at his glass studio, and it's an early stage. He's very happy. Everyone's happy. And then he's got this line of long brush, and he's painting a psych. What was amazing about that is they obviously did his face, but then we just looked at the stereo of the rest of that shot. Now, there was, I guess, an edge violation at the bottom of frame for the corner of the stage, though somebody had thoughtfully darkened that down so it didn't bother anyone. And then there was just lovely stereo depth right the way through that shot. So leaving aside Lola's work, which was great, but obviously the character they were de-aging was quite small in shot. Just at every point, it seemed like somebody had loved that shot in terms of stereo. The distance, the mid-ground, it was just so well composed. And just parking on a shot like that obviously isn't a big effect shot, and appreciating how much work went into the stereo, I started to get an appreciation of why, and including myself, why everyone's been raving about the stereo in this, because you guys really sort of folded the stereo into the filmmaking in a way that we haven't seen for a while. It really felt front of the thought process, not an afterthought, as we're seeing with other films. Is that, I mean, it must be the case.
No, that is absolutely the case. And, you know, that's why I recommend that. And again, film is a cumulative art form. So you set up the first shot and say, you know, that sort of works, but what would be more interesting is this. And all of a sudden you start to teach yourself in a tasteful, artistic way, what works and what doesn't. And what to go for. Now, if you know, it's not like the dimensionalization of films are bad in the technique that's being done, but it's like you never learn from it. You shoot everything without any knowledge, any building block knowledge of how to start to compose, how to start to light, how to start to dress the sets like it. And everything is like your very first time trying it without your taste factor, your own particular as an artist taste factor of what are you trying to accomplish or establish? And, you know, 50 people later, you know, come up with that who are not artists necessarily, and not to discredit them or anything, but they just know how to make stereo. They don't know how to make stereo tell the story, nor can they change it. They can't say, oh, now that we see it, we would have introduced some more foreground elements, we would have done this, we would have done that. So all that art that's involved in just pure composition we're now composing in depth too. So the same eye for composition is also the same eye for compositional depth, and then what it brings to the party. And then now that you're viewing it in the same medium with which you're going to display it, you know that the shot is on too long, it's not on long enough, somebody needs to take another step in, they need to take a step out, somebody needs to be a little, you know, a more downstage or upstage. You now make adjustments based on, I'm now seeing the stuff. So you artistically choose each and every portion of it. And, you know, because I was a second unit director too, I get on the set and it's like, well, now I've got the bare bones of the shot. Now let me start dealing with depth. So let me bring this in here. Let me add some steam over here. I'm going to add some dust particles in the foreground. I'm going to do this. And you start painting a depth picture as well. And then the whole, you know, unit is then judged for its artistic merits. Does it tell the story? Does it advance the story? Is it just a piece of fluff? Is it just a 3D gag? No, it's not. It's storytelling in depth, and using depth as a artistic tool, not a gimmick or a gag that you throw on top. I always use the example of it because I think it's applicable, is when color first came in, color was a gag. So now you have to put, you know, if you look at Robin Hood, as great a film as it is, it's pretty garish color. Mm. It is like, put him in this green tights and put him in this thing and make all these, and because you're selling the new gag that we're using, which is color. Then later, it's like, okay, well, now that's the, you know, the tail wagging the dog. It wasn't done necessarily for the art of the movie. It was done for the art of the color. So now it starts to get incorporated into a movie, and all of a sudden what someone wears and how they wear it and how bright it is in the frame means something. It has an artistic quality to it. The blending of colors becomes part of the toolbox of the production designer and the director and the costumer and all of a sudden art starts to leak back into it, as opposed to let's just show off how colorful we could make things. So that's what I think that we did in this movie, is said it is not a gag, it is not a science project, it is part of the art form of making the movie, and every shot is judged on its merits of how does depth improve the story we're telling. And I think, you know, like in all things, the sum total of it, it's all like the little gags we were talking about that we put in. It's the sum total, the sort of gestalt of the entire movie makes you feel a certain way. And I think people are responding to that alone. They're responding to the sum total of what they saw as, you know, at some point, I didn't even know I was watching a 3D movie anymore. I was just watching a movie. And the 3D was a natural part of the storytelling. It wasn't like I noticed when I watch other 3D movies, I tend to take the glasses off every once in a while, mm-hmm. To check the stuff and see what it looks like. And, you know, and that means I'm not in the moment. I'm watching something else. I'm interested in something else. And when we screen these movies, we didn't see anybody take the glasses off.
No, we were on the edge of our seat hoping that that when they're up on the chair trying to get into the secret compartment, they don't get broken and busted. And it was great.
You know what I love too, sort of going off on a tangent, is, you know, I've done it to death. Everybody's done it to death. Who's done a visual effects movie is somebody hanging from a high place and, you know, the same compliment of shot. And all of a sudden you add 3D and it was like, holy shit, that really is cool. You know, I did one shot that was so simple that I loved, and I loved that Marty kept it in, was I was on the double, so I couldn't really show his face, but I just do a little crane move above his head. He's sitting on the ledge of the clock outside, and yep. I just move the camera. I just move it like a 3 feet, maybe very slight. But I knew what the sensation that you'd get, this, you know, vertiginous sort of sensation. And, you know, it's like, well, I couldn't get that in 2D. It just, you know, it wouldn't yep. work.
No, you exactly know? The shot you mean. Yeah. Tell me, how'd you find the Alexas?
Oh, fantastic!
Yeah,
I think they're the best digital camera in the world. You know, it was, I mean, you know, my bias comes from, you know, love of shooting film because of what the image quality looks like. And you know, having grown up with, you know, digital effects, basically when I started was the beginning of digitizing film in log format doing your work on it, and if you don't change it, if you don't alter the properties of it, and you print it back out exactly as you saw it, it looks identical to film. And it was, you wouldn't be able to see the difference if I showed you the non-digital version or the actual film itself. In fact, when I was doing Apollo, I'd approve that to Dean Cundey, where I mix them up. I would scan, you have footage scanned in, and then show him interspersed with his dailies, and I say pick out the digital version of it because he didn't believe it. And you know, it's very meticulous that you don't alter the properties of it to make it not look like film anymore. But at any rate, it does that. So now the Alexa, that's what it does. So it basically is as if it was shot on film and digitized, and the Log-C image that you get has the same sort of tonal range, the same latitude as that, so instantly it looks like film, or it looks like what I'm used to seeing. And then you could choose to, you know, in the DI, make it anything you want. But it was, you know, it fit in perfectly with what I like and what I think works and all that.
This is probably more a question for the DP, but just because I've got you, I heard you were shooting on Cooks, including, I mean, I know that it's the S4 and the fives, but also heard you were shooting on the Pancros, the newer, smaller one. You just stuck on those Cooks, right? They were like good glass.
We were only on primes. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have one other question. Obviously, I maybe should have started this earlier, but one of the magical / interesting aspects of the film is the automaton, the mechanical boy. And it's obviously an incredible piece of engineering in the film. I'm wondering how much incredible engineering you did in real life and how much where the visual effects came into play, because it's probably a big ask for an art department to make one that would actually draw that picture.
They built one that actually drew that picture.
Really? Wow.
I used motion control to control the hand underneath the desk, but it took 45 minutes, and it actually, they could draw that complete picture, you know, identically. It would take 45 minutes to actually hand draw it. So, I mean, because I shot it, you know, I had to, you know, truncate that time frame and all that stuff. But
motion control under the desk, do you mean it was like magnetically driven, or?
Yes, it was magnetically driven. And so it would move the, they built a program, and, an artist, drew the picture and then they figured out the coordinates of how to make it move to actually draw it. And literally, I mean, it was, if you could look really closely, you'll see a ballpoint tip on the end of the pen that's actually doing the physical drawing. But, and then some of it I shot here in LA, you know, the same stage I shot the train crash, I shot, the automaton drawing, but it did all that stuff. And the only stuff that it didn't, that we did, that was really CG, is in a couple of shots, because of the nature of how it was shot, Marty wanted to use a take where it starts up, and he only had a piece where it was stationary, where it wasn't, the thing wasn't moving. So we put in new guts and started it up. And then at the very end of the movie, as soon as you go into that hallway to see the automaton for the end, the hallway, or the room, the curtains, everything is CG, including the automaton for the close-up, to going into the close-up to his face. So we blend into a real Steadicam shot, and it's pure CG at that point, the whole thing. And then, of course, the him being tossed in midair is it's all a computer-generated version of it.
As you had quite a bit of green screen on set, and you mentioned earlier at the end of the station looking back one way didn't exist, what did you do?
Didn't exist. No ceiling. You look to the right, there's green screen. You look to the left, there's green screen. You look out the front door, there's green. So it's a 360 green throughout the whole thing. But the station itself, where the trains are, that didn't really exist in any kind of cohesive form. So that was all. In fact, in the opening shot, when we were traveling from high above the station and going through all those people, I mean, all those were shot separately on treadmills and things like that, and put into that shot. As soon as the dust clears or the smoke clears, that's the actual, the camera started to get up to speed to do that shot through the stage door. And so we've traversed the entire stage in that, what was built in that one shot.
Do you have any, you must have had some kind of on-set, live sort of aid for framing and lineup in terms of a CG or something, did you?
Yes, that was part of the extension of the previs, is I would previs the shots, so we have everything built, and then that set that I was prevising would be in Motion Builder on the set, and the Luma Crane and some of our other cameras were all encoded. So instead of doing the motion capture version of capturing the camera, we did the encoded version of capturing the camera. And so basically, wherever you move the crane, you're moving the computer generated crane, which is photographing the previs background, so that we could frame. So it became sort of an extension of virtual cinematography.
So we've mentioned Edson and Lola, but we really must mention, I guess, Ben Grossman and the team. Can you talk about your team?
Yeah, well, the main sort of effects house is Pixamundo, and Lola was always going to be, you know, it was always our first choice to do the de-aging. Ben, I'd worked with Ben on a couple of Marty projects before, and, you know, to do these movies is slightly different than a normal visual effects film. It's actually not slightly, it's quite a bit different, is there's no overage sheets, there's no approval sheets and 24 hours to make up your mind, or, you know, well, that there is none of that. Marty doesn't sign anything. No shot is ever in or out of the movie, and we make changes up to the very last second. And so you sort of have to know that in advance so that you don't get yourself into hot water pretty quickly, you know, by sort of posturing of that. So Ben, you know, certainly knew that, and I know him technically. He's quite excellent character and all that. So he was with me when I was shooting, because I was doing the second unit stuff. So I'd have him on main unit until they needed me for, you know, some sort of design thing or what I had in mind or something. But he would take care of all of the making sure we got all the photographs done and all the sort of day-to-day visual effects supervision portion of it. And then another guy who's very good is Alex Henning, who works with Ben. They're sort of a team. He came out, and he, is a fantastic compositor. So he would composite some of the shots that we were working on that we had, you know, and one of the great things about shooting with the Alexa is, or any digital camera for that matter, but the Alexa in particular, because the quality is so good, is that we're able to do, you know, instant turnaround comps, you know, half hour later, you could see what almost looks like a final composite, to ensure that it's all working. You know, we did that with the mouse stuff in particular, because obviously I shot it separately, and we did a comp in 3D and we projected it and everybody was happy with it and we moved on, type stuff. And we did that quite a bit in some of the other things. You know, what is this background going to look like? And since the background is going to look like this, how does it affect how I shoot it and some of the sort of the matte painting, Paris location shots, we needed to really see what it looked like and a little better quality sometimes than what you can get on the set with a live, sort of Ultimate. And so he would do that. And then when Ben was having his first baby, went back to LA, Alex took over, and he was the on-set visual effects supervisor. I mean, I still would, you know, I would be on the next stage, so if there's anything that Marty needed to discuss with me, I'd go over there. But, you know, any of the stuff where we're just technically, you know, we know what the shot is, we now just need to make sure that everything is done correctly, those guys would take care of. And then Ben and I shot all the people for, I was the cameraman as well, of course, and all the people for the opening shot. We shot them, basically they're all stationary except for the ones on treadmills, for the ones that are walking. And I lit it to look like it would be correct to be lit in that opening shot that you've never seen, actually.
That's true. But I'm sure see it when I go back to the cinema.
Take a close look at it. It's actually worked out really well. I don't want to over-compliment my own work, but
No, it looked good in the previous. So I'm sure it's going to look good in the final.
It's actually turned out really well, and I was very happy the way it was lit. And you believe you're that close. They better be real people, otherwise you're going to pick them apart. And so they are. And, you know, the science and industry of just even accomplishing that was something we did. And they did a pretty brilliant job of rendering the trains and the stuff. In fact, all the trains in the movie, with the exception of when he walks through the train, it's all CG trains. I mean, the parked ones and things like that.
And presumably the miniature that smashes through in the dream, there are about three shots there, I think, aren't there, from New Deal we talked about earlier?
Right. Yeah.
And so This is what I love about this film, is that like you've used every technique, but as we discussed with that coal shit, you've kind of done the trickery in the inventive magic sense that the film is about. Do you know what I mean? It's like an ultimate self-referential thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even self-referential. It's revering the genius that came before us. Sasha's a very inventive guy and wanted to do something funny with the train and all that stuff. And that was the day we had the train. We had one day in this giant long cross thing. It was basically a train and green screen. It was all it was. And we could only have the train for, I think, a day or 2 days or something like that. He wanted to do a thing where the train somehow catches onto his leg, or his leg catches onto the train as it's coming to the station, and he gets yanked and pulled. And it was about, I don't know, 3 days before we shot it. He wanted to do this thing. It's like, well, how do we do it? And so we did the old gag of had the art department build a floor that's on a track and put a camera on it, and the train stationary, and but he's not, and it looks like, you know, it's the cheapest gag in the world, you know, in terms of that. But whoever thought of it the first time was the real genius, and we just did that, and we wanted to do it because it was, again, you know, hearkening back to a different time. Now, I don't think anybody picks up on that except for us chickens, but because, you know, if you look at it and you believe that the train's moving, it's like, well, what's the gag? And unless you wanted to do it, then you say, yeah, well, think of the mechanics of actually having a train back up to do take after take, safely, you know, latch on to his leg.
To a star of the film, yeah, not a stuntman.
Yeah, not a stuntman. And, you know, if you think about how to accomplish it, you would then go, holy shit, that's pretty ballsy, you know, way of doing it. Or you wouldn't necessarily think, oh, well, you just slide the floor underneath it. And what we did in this particular movie that you generally don't see in that is that we photographed the floor that you're on. Like in Titanic, you know, Jim did the same thing where he had a platform, but you're chopping off the platform that they're on. And you just basically see stationary people and things and objects, and it goes by. And, you know, obviously you bought that the boat was moving out. But in this one, you're actually seeing the floor as part of the gag. You need to see him on the floor being drugged by the train. And so we did that. You know, I made it up. And the fun part is, you know, once, you know, one of the movie stars says he wants to do it, and once Marty says he wants to do it, it's just like, go figure it out. And all right. And it's the crazier the idea, doesn't really make a difference. You're building it, you know, a floor that's 40 feet long to get the timing of how much he has to do, how far does the camera go back, where can I actually stage it, what is the gag of the thing actually hitting it. So we thought of the door opening up, because how else is it going to get caught on it? So the door opens up, and the, you know, so we did all that stuff in a very short period of time, and love the fact that it was an old illusionary gag. And of course it's against green screen, so now you make the background stationary too, and it doubly or triply sells the idea. And you know, it was, you know, that's in there too, an old gag that probably Howard Lloyd did, or you know, Buster Keaton or somebody.
Yeah, no, it is, it's terrific. And you know, it's such a great fun film, but then, as I say, like there's this, you start to watch it, it starts to dawn on you some of the things that you're looking at and some of the aspects about it. And I must say, one of the things that I imagined you had just great fun with just in finishing is you actually did get to recreate scenes from the films that are so iconic that they're the logo for the Visual Effects Society's, you know, mm-hmm. awards. I mean, this is sort of hallowed ground, as it were, and you got to redo those films. I mean, who gets to do that?
Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, to go into that studio, rebuild it from. I mean, and that was an example of me as the visual effects supervisor and whatever saying no to something, which is they wanted to do it all against green screen. And it's like, A, I don't have the dough for it anyway. But I could never make the best I could do is make it look like that, and. You know, and the worst I could do is not make it look as good as that. For what reason? There's no benefit from it. It's like, build the damn thing and go shoot it, because that's exactly what was done back then. Why should we do anything less now? And so it became, all right, well, now you start to build it. Well, okay, what if you add the top? Well, what if I don't? You know, if I add the top later, it's going to cost you X number of thousands of dollars. And every time you show the ceiling, that's another shot that costs, you know, $15,000, $20,000 a pop or whatever it's going to be. Don't do it. You know, that's do this in camera because it is an in camera gag. And, you know, they basically gave up because I wouldn't relent.
But and if I'm not mistaken, they actually ended up filming many of those scenes using only the available light that came through the glass stage. Yeah. So in fact, it actually worked. I mean, it completely worked.
Yeah, I mean, it worked exactly as that. Now, of course, I had to shoot some scenes in that same place, and of course, it's in the middle of winter, so light is pretty low. And there's a couple shots in there where I had to artificially light it to look like it was lit by natural sunlight. So I picked my angles and did whatever, and I don't think anybody knows, you know, which ones I shot and which ones were lit, you know, shot in the middle of the night, really, because I just ran out of time. You know, just had no time. So, but first unit, they were wrapped out of there by the time it got dark, and I didn't have that luxury. So.
Just in finishing up, how long did you have, by the way, after principal photography to get this film finished? Was it did you have a luxury of time, or was it because I understand that Pixel Mondo did a kind of 24-hour round the clock because of the global nature of the company, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, well, there's that, and although it sounds like we had a lot of time, you know, in the structure of the way the movie works with Thelma and Marty, it's not that way. But we wrapped, we finished the last scene, or I finished the last scene in January, the last day, which is I shot the close-ups of the train wheels, and that's where I destroyed the camera on the last day, the stereo rig and the camera.
What happened?
I was shooting the there's the other thing is like, well, can you do the close-up of the wheels CG? I said, well, I can, but I don't want to. You know, it's another one of those blur the line things. Sure. Like, I don't want to go and shoot the damn thing. You know, I want to take it out, take a camera out there, mount it onto the stuff. And, you know, when I designed the previs, I designed it to be able to rig and get those shots. So it was something that my back pocket, we could do it in CG, but I really wanted to shoot it. And so we went out and we went to this place and we had it all checked out and rigged and all that stuff. And the rig had to be just so and so much clearance. And then we had to find a parcel of land that was safe. And so I was shooting something else the day before and had the crew go out there and do it. And they blocked off the area. And then I came to shoot it and we were shooting and having a great time because it just looked, you know, really cool. It was just looked awesome. Then the train engineer, while I lowered the camera and moved it a little further out, even though they said, oh, you really shouldn't do it, it's like, we're in the middle of nowhere. Nothing's going to hit it. And, of course, famous last words. So I do that. And that's the time that the engineer of the train decided to go further than he showed everyone. And as far as he went into an area that there was a brick wall, and it clipped the camera and just completely destroyed it. So we're just getting off on this shot because it looks so damn cool. And all of a sudden it's like whack, and it just like went. And that was the end of that. There's no more cameras. So I hope I got everything I needed but it was the last thing of the last day.
Now tell me that you weren't on board recording.
Oh no, we were recording. We're shooting.
You say you got the shot.
Yeah, we got the shot before you got it. Basically wrenched the camera and twisted the entire rig and destroyed one Alexa, though it's completely gone, and of course the stereo rig. It twisted the shit out of the mirror. It broke the mirror, obviously, and twisted the shit out of the. All right, so you can't repair it. You just have to throw it away, and screwed up the lens mount of the other Arri camera that we had, and it was like, I guess it's a wrap then. The last day.
Surely you can find a place somewhere in your mantelpiece to put, someone that's got a museum somewhere. They'd love to have a wrecked stereo rig off Hugo, because that's just too funny.
But that's what happened. Oh, so at any rate, that was a tangent of the story. But that was the very last thing we shot in January, and then the film just came out now. So we had from January. But you don't really have that time. What you have is set up time for everything else, and then they have to cut the movie. And when, you know, Thelma and Marty cut the movie, there's all the people who never worked with them before are saying, so we're going to get a lock cut by June. No, you're not. you're not going to get anywhere close to a lock cut by June. You're going to get a lock cut as soon as you take the movie away from them is when the cut gets locked. And so that's ultimately what occurred is, you know, so everything had to be adjusted for that. So you have to wait a certain period of time to start getting the shots and say, I think these are going to be in. I'm pretty sure they're going to be in. I'm pretty sure these are going to be out. And then, you know, you do make mistakes along the way in terms of, you know, you're dead sure that that scene's going to remain. And so you do all the work on it. So we did about close to 100 shots that were ultimately cut out of the movie at the last minute.
But, you know, that's great fodder for the DVD extras.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of them are like right up to the limit. They are, you know, absolutely. And one of them I asked to be put back in. Which is when he's chasing, in the beginning of the movie, he's chasing the Hugo, and the camera cranes up, and you see from inside the concourse what the, you know, where the trains would be. That was cut out, and I asked, you know, if they wouldn't mind cutting it back in, because I thought we could pull off that shot and give you more of a sense of place. And then the very next shot is based on a previs I did where he's running and knocking people over, and then he can't find Hugo, and the camera cranes up and reveals that Hugo is up on the gantry structure, and then the train goes underneath him, and the smoke, you know, basically takes over the frame. And that was based on a previs that we did. So I thought that would be a good companion for that, and Marty was gracious enough to cut it back into the picture.
Well, look, I think the film was terrific. Obviously, it's had a very good reception. You must be very proud of it. And what's unbelievable to me is that you guys, as a collective team, though obviously some of you had, but most of you hadn't done a bunch of stereo films before this. So,
Ben had some experience on Alice, but that was a, you know, essentially a 2D film that was 3D, you know, converted. Not that some CG stuff wasn't done in 3D, but, you know, so he had that experience. But no, I don't think anybody had an experience of actually shooting in 3D on the day outside of the Pace group. Certainly Bob didn't, I didn't, Marty didn't. You know, we learned, I think, the appropriate way of doing it, which is it's an art, it's part of the art form. It's not a gag. It's not something to be ignored and just stage a shot. Yeah, whatever stereo you want to do is fine. It was always meant to be. Now that we're staged it, now we want to see how the staging works in stereo, sit there and judge it, and then determine that, you know, you are going to make any adjustments and move on, as opposed to we're just shooting no matter what. A lot of people shoot in stereo on the day, but they only look at a 2D monitor, and that's I believe, a mistake. Or an artistic mistake at any rate.
Yeah, you guys made a really good film in 3D, but first and foremost it was always intended to be viewed three-dimensionally, wasn't it? I mean, it just this is the film you want seen stereo.
Yeah, correct. This was definitely conceived as a 3D movie. It wasn't a movie that will also be in 3D, will also be in 2D. You know, even though we have to do the 2D deliverables, we didn't want to necessarily. And the Ace color correction and everything else is the 3D version of the movie. That is the movie. The other ones are derivatives, you know, of that. But it was clearly not just making a movie and add 3D to it. It was every judgment call was based on it being a 3D film.
Well, look, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us. I really appreciate it. And happy Thanksgiving weekend. And again, I really appreciated the film and thought it was terrific.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And there's a ton of work in there. There's 800 shots in there for that thing.
Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, the critics who are reporting on it are attributing, you know, all of that to Dante Ferretti and Bob Richardson's swooping camera going through these things. Like, well, okay, yeah.
Honestly, anyone that's seen a stereo rig would know that it wouldn't be possible. And then as you study it more, it becomes completely apparent that there is just so much interesting work in there that had to have been done with visual effects. But, you know, that's the wonderful thing about it. I mean, in terms of the context of the film and in terms of just the final film, I think it's, you know, that is a bit of a compliment to you in a sense, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's what we strive for, is that there are no visual effects. We're just all filmmakers and we're making a movie. And what the end result is that you're entertained by what you see, as opposed to you put it back in its cubby holes of this is photography, this is art direction, this is, you know, costume. Although we do that to award it, you know, quite frankly, the sum total, I mean, that's why it's so magical to redo the those shots we were doing for the glass studio, is that the sum total of the glass structure, the props of the old cameras and the old cameramen and the costumes, the collective is just awesome looking. And you could say, yeah, it's a really beautiful photograph, but it's really beautiful because there's beautiful costumes in it. It's a beautiful set. The backdrops are really great. The composition's really great. The 3D enhances it. All of the various things make up. And so in our case too, you know, our work is being disguised by, in many cases, it being invisible in the movie, where you just think, well, there's a station back there, but there really isn't.
Rob, you've just reminded me of one thing that I've been desperate to ask, and I would have killed myself if I'd not remembered to ask you this. We'd like to do a lot of research before we do these interviews, but there's one thing I haven't been able to find out for sure, though I've been researching it hard. I'm sure the guy to ask. In those shots where they were shooting in the film, they're shooting a film in the glass studio, there are two cameras beside each other for some of those setups, two hand crank cameras. Now, as I understand it, in real life, French archivists discovered that there were actually two negs of some of those films. When they tried putting them together, they realized they were offset in effectively the X-axis, even though they seemed to be in sync. And there's a theory that they were hand-cranked at the same time off the same hand crank, so they'd have two negatives. So one negative could go to America for prints, and one could stay in Europe for prints because they didn't do interpos and interneg. Is that true, or was it a long lens and a wide lens? What was going on there?
No, that was exactly true. The story that I was told was that there was something to do, and you see the evidence when you see George's films, that he puts the star in it, so that I think what happened is Edison, I think Marty called him the first film pirate, basically would just take the things and reprint them and run the movie, and he would keep all the money. And there was no proof that it was anybody else's film but his, so George started to put in those stars and everything, and shot one negative for America and one negative for Europe. At least I was told that. And what happened is, because he put them side by side and he was trying to photograph exactly the same thing, the camera angles were set up in such a way that it actually was able to produce 3D. There wasn't meant to do 3D at the time, at least I don't believe so, but being what George was, if he was able to do that, and somebody would think of it, for sure. And we saw the Lumiere brothers do it, that same thing, is basically they had we saw a couple clips of their version of 3D in like 1918 or something like that. But somebody put it together. They found the two negs. They must have been in sync. Maybe it must have had a common angle. Otherwise, two hand crank things photograph the same thing would destroy the 3D effect. I mean, it would be impossible.
You'd go out of sync in seconds, right?
Yeah, they would have to be exactly in sync, because otherwise the fact that they're off creates a 3D effect. You know, if the one arm is in one area, and if you just think about, you know, how 3D everything has to be offset, well, it could be offset in motion, you know, by being a frame out of sync, and it'll give you the sensation of 3D. But at any rate, that's what was done, and we were sort of confident, or we say that if he would have found that out, and if he continued to make films, he would have done 3D, because that would be the next trick that he would have come up with, and he already had the material to do it with and the practice with and all that stuff. So,
wow. Well, thanks for solving that, because no matter how hard we researched, we couldn't get confirmation of that. So thanks. And I did notice the two cameras.
That was definitely done, for sure. That's why we had two cameras in those scenes photographing it as well.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for that. And thanks for talking to us.
Oh, you're most welcome. My pleasure.
Once upon a time, I met a boy named Hugo Cabret. He searched to find a secret message.
I need to know what this means.
And how that message lit his way. All the way home.
Well, thanks, Mike, and to Rob. And also, if you want to hear more from Rob, we did an interview back in March with him, March of 2011, on FX Guide TV, episode number 105. If you just search for Rob Legato In the FX Guide search box, you'll find it, or in iTunes even. If you search for FX Guide TV, Rob Legato, you'll probably find it. Anyway, check it out. Very wide-ranging interview about Rob's career and some of the films he's worked on, and really good stories. As you can hear, he's a great storyteller and anecdotes galore. So check that out as well. Well, that'll do it for this FX podcast. I'm Jeff Huser. For my partners Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, we'll see you on the next FX podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.